I want to share with you my message today, which is about Joseph, Mary, and the baby Jesus fleeing to Egypt. And you may notice that I'm following the biblical chronology. The biblical chronology is that in both Matthew and Luke, Jesus is born. In the Luke version, you have the shepherds who come to visit Jesus. In the Matthew version, we have the wise men. And so last week I preached about the wise men bringing gifts. Today, we focus again on the aftermath of the wise men. And you can read this for yourself if you want to get the whole story. Start in Matthew 1 and then go to Matthew 2. But today we focus on the departure of the wise men, which is in Matthew chapter 2. And let me share this with you, starting at verse 13. Now, after they had left, this is talking about the wise men. Now, after they had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night. He took the child and mother by night and went to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. So that is our lesson for today. And I want to share with you from my perspective a hypothesis. Let me share with you what a hypothesis is. A hypothesis is a reasonable guess. It's a reasonable supposition, but we can't really prove it. But I want to share with you my hypothesis of five possible reasons why Joseph took Mary to Egypt. Number one, Egypt, and I'm going to start with these five reasons and I'm going to come back to them. Number one, Egypt was in close proximity to Bethlehem. Number two, Egypt was prosperous. Number three, Egypt was dense with a lot of dark-skinned people. If I don't know how many people here have ever been to Egypt, but if you go to Egypt, the original Egyptians are very dark-skinned. They're called Nubians. Number three, Egypt had a worshiping community. I think I'm on four now. Egypt had a worshiping community that was similar to the original worship of God in the time of Moses. When Moses called on God, with the name Yahweh. Sometimes the Jewish people also called on God with another name, Elohim. But these people were steeped in the same religious tradition as in Moses. And you may remember Moses led the people out of Egypt to go to the promised land. But there were some people who became disaffected with Moses. We read about it in the Bible where the Bible tells us that the Hebrew people, some of them grumbled against Moses because it seemed like Moses didn't know where he was going or what he was doing. And so they became disaffected with Moses. But this is a very old religious tradition. And perhaps you may have heard several years ago in Ethiopia, there was an airlift of Ethiopians to Israel. And the airlift took place among a group of Ethiopians called the Falasha Jews. And to this day, what we found out about the Falasha Jews is that their form of Judaism is more pristine, more primitive than the modern Israelite. And you may say, but Reverend, how can that be? And it's because the modern Israelites, many of those who are in power today, like Netanyahu and the new prime minister and others, these are people who have ancestry that goes back to Europe. And so if you look very closely at the Falasha Jews, many of whom who are in Israel today, they have a very, very pristine form of Judaism. And at some point, you know, that's not really the point of my sermon today, but I have met them. I've been to Ethiopia. I've seen them in Ethiopia, and I've seen them in Israel. And what I learned from Israeli scholars is that the Falasha Jews have a more original form of Judaism than what we find in Israel even to this day. Number five in my hypothesis is that Mary and Joseph may have chosen to go to Egypt because maybe they knew somebody there. Maybe they had word that somebody had gone on before them. And let me circle back to number one, which ties in to number five. Number one is that Egypt was simply close. It was in close proximity to Israel. And you know, we've taken church trips to Israel. We've taken church trips to Egypt. And one of the things we found is that you can drive between the two. It's not particularly a long distance. And so Mary and Joseph know what they're doing. There's a reason why they go to Egypt and not Jordan. Not Syria, not Babylon, not Persia. There's a reason why. And I think one of the reasons simply was because it was close. Number two, Egypt was prosperous. Egypt is right on the Mediterranean Sea, but frankly, so is Israel. But Egypt is located in a place where the merchant trade from Europe, from Rome, could sail through the Mediterranean Sea. They land in Egypt, and then from Egypt, they are right on the coast of Africa, on the northern coast. And so Egypt is in a place of just great proximity. And, you know, we learn later that Joseph was a carpenter by trade. A carpenter can find work anywhere. And I think that Joseph may have thought that if we go to Egypt, I can find work and I can take care of my family. One of the other things we learned in traveling to Egypt was that the Holy Family was on the move. It's not like the Holy Family went to the local five-star hotel. They didn't go to great expensive places to stay. But when they go to Egypt, Mary and Joseph, and they didn't just stay in Cairo. Mary and Joseph are on the move. And you can Google this for yourself. But one of the things that I learned in that process is that when they set foot in Egypt, they were concerned that Herod and his men were still chasing them. And so there's a circuitous route of hundreds of miles that Mary and Joseph followed, taking the baby of Jesus. And they took the baby Jesus on this circuitous route because they were afraid that Herod might kill him. And let me refresh your memory. Why is Herod upset with the baby Jesus? This is what I preached on last week. Herod wants to kill the baby Jesus because the wise men showed up in Jerusalem asking a simple question: where is he that is born King of the Jews? And this upset Herod because Herod was the titular King of the Jews. He was the quote unquote King of the Jews, but Herod himself was not a Jew. And so Herod is always looking backwards and asking himself, do people look at me as though I am an imposter? And so Herod issues an order that says, all the children under 2 years of age shall be killed, all the boys, the male children. And this is why Mary and Joseph leave. They leave Bethlehem for Egypt. And so this is where the story begins today. And I encourage you, if you have an opportunity, Google the flight of the Holy Family in Egypt. And you will find all kinds of things. But what it will tell you is that it was a long route. And it may have been more than 3 years. Traditionally, in the Christian church, we are taught to believe that Mary and Joseph remained in Egypt for about 3 years. Dr. Ben Yochanan, I don't know if any of you know that name, but in our old, he actually spoke at our old church on the lower level. He spoke in this church on the lower level. When we first opened up in 1974, you know, I authorized bringing him here because I had read about him in divinity school. But Dr. Ben Yochanan has a theory that Jesus, Mary, and Joseph remained in Egypt for maybe as much as 12 years. And if Jesus remained in Egypt as much as 12 years, there's a strong likelihood that Jesus was educated in an Egyptian educational framework. And that's part of Ben Yochanan's contribution, part of his thought process. But be that as it may, the important thing is that Mary and Joseph fled to Egypt. And they fled in a way that the modern parents respond. Many of the people who are here have been parents of young children. And if you've ever raised a child, think about the kinds of decisions you make as a parent, the kind of decisions you make as a grandparent. And what parents historically have done since Adam and Eve is to try to figure out, how do I help my child grow in the best possible way? And one of the things that we learn in the process is that the young mother, the young father, have to make decisions on the fly. They have to make decisions very quickly. And because every situation is different. And because every situation is different, the mother and the father, they will try to figure out where's the best place to live, where's the best place to put my child in school. We have grandparents with us. Who have raised their grandchildren because they know in their heart that their own child was not able to do a proper job of raising the grandchildren. And so mothers and fathers historically have acted in this way and reacted, just like Mary and Joseph. And to me, that's one of the beautiful things of life. The other point that I want to make about this story of Mary and Joseph going to Egypt is that when Joseph is told in a dream that Herod wants to kill his child, and think about that. You know, what a heady experience it must have been for Joseph and Mary to learn that Mary was carrying a Christ child And within days after the birth of the Christ child, they learned that the king of the land wants their child. Not just any child, but the king of the land wants to kill their child. That would be like the president of the United States saying, I want to kill your child. Out of all the people in the world. And without really saying why. And in a sense, when Mary and Joseph learn that Herod wants to kill their child, it's the political and real equivalent of a curveball being thrown at you. And let me share with you about the curveball. I only played baseball through Little League. And when I played baseball in Little League, the boys, and it was all boy, male experience, the pitchers that I had to face had not yet learned how to throw the curveball. There's something about the position of the fingers on the ball. And if they throw it in a certain way, the ball begins to arc. And it's very confusing from what I understand. I never had to face a curveball in baseball. But I did have to face the fastball. And the fastball was frightening enough for me. But from what I understand, the curveball, when it's thrown, it starts arcing. And it may arc to the left, to the right, depending on if the pitcher is a left hand or a right-handed pitcher. Bill Middlebrooks, who's a member of the church who played a little baseball longer than I did, I called him Friday and I said, man, explain to me about the curveball. How does that really work? And he said, well, Nick, I tell you, he said, Al Kaline, who was a great batter for the Detroit Tigers, was once asked that question, how do you hit a curveball when that ball is curving? And he said, Al Kaline's very famous comment was, you hit the curveball the same way you hit the fastball. And he said, you have to figure that out. He said, but basically, you know, he says it's the same thing. You have to watch the ball and then you hit it. And in life, there are all kinds of curveballs. You think your life is going in one direction and then you find out you have cancer. That's a curveball. You're living your life and you find out that you have multiple sclerosis. That's a curveball. You live your life, you think your life is going well, then your mother or your father dies. That's a curveball. You think your life is going well, but then you lose your job. That's another curveball. And all through life, there are curveballs that are thrown at us. And the successful person is the one who figures out, how do I hit that curveball? Even though it's coming at me fast, even though it is moving in a different direction, how do I figure it out? Divorce can be a curveball. Death can be a curveball. Desertion can be a curveball. And the curveball, my friends, is not the end of life. The curveball is really just a challenge. It's another blip in the road. And in my opinion, the successful person is the one who figures out, how do I hit that curveball? How do I hit the curveball? Last night, I don't know how many of you watched the University of Michigan lose to, they call it TCU. But the real name of TCU is Texas Christian University. And it's funny, you know, the commentators really don't want to call it Texas Christian University. They call it TCU. But I watched that whole game last night, and it really bothered me. And then at midnight, what time was it? I get my time zones mixed up, but I got a call from Ernest Harden Jr. He grew up in our church. He's an actor of note. He's been in 60 plays. He was on the original cast of the Jeffersons. Went to Sunday school with me right here at Plymouth United Church of Christ. And so Ernest called me, and he wanted to tease me about Michigan losing last night, because Ernest went to Michigan State. And I had to remind Ernest, I said, look, brother, I went to Wayne State. I said, that game doesn't mean a thing to me. I said, but they're from Michigan. And so, I watched the game, and I rooted for them. I said, but you can't tease me about that game. And he and I were talking about it and then trying to dissect the game. And I said, Ernest, let me share with you one thing I noticed in the game. And he said, what's that? I said, Texas Christian University, the first play on the line of scrimmage, after Michigan got that first long run, I said, the first play, they lined up in a three-man offense. I said, do you understand what a three-man offense, defense means? He said, no, what is that? I said, a three-man defense represents at least two things. Number one, it's considered universally as the ultimate sign of disrespect. It is, Michael, you played football. It is considered the ultimate disrespect from a defensive team. These guys from Texas lined up not with a traditional five or more men on the defensive line. They lined up with only three. But they were big. They were big boys. They were big boys. And, they were so big. Commentator noted they were 20 to 30 pounds bigger than the Michigan offensive linemen. And all year long, people have been bragging about the Michigan line, how big they are and how strong they are. But one of the commentators last night, at the very beginning of the game, he said, Texas Christian University is very confident in the strength of their defensive line. And I said, what is going on? And sure enough, the first play that Michigan had, they got stopped. I don't know if you all noticed that in the game. And I said, oh, this is a game. I said, this is a game tonight. And they went on and won the game. So I tell you one reason. It's that three-man line is considered the ultimate disrespect, at least from my knowledge of football. If you will line up against five people with only three people, that is a disrespect. That's your way of saying, we can beat you. We can beat you with only, we can beat you with less people than what you have lined up against us. And we are confident that we can beat you. They started that game last night saying, we can beat you. The other point about the three-man defense, on defensive line, and I shared this with Ernest last night, I said, you can beat a three-man defense. It's overcomable. I said, but the coach has got to change the plan. And I think when they analyzed why Michigan lost last night, it's because the coaching staff did not adjust. They did not adjust to that curveball. And I'm sure Michigan has not faced a three-man line all year long. I can't believe anybody in the Big Ten would line up against Michigan with only three people. But these Christians from Texas lined up with only three people, and they freaked Michigan out. And so what's the point that I'm making? The point that I'm making, my friends, is that life is full of curveballs. And the real question is not the curveball, but rather the real question in life is, what do you do with it? And if you don't adjust, and what would Michigan's adjustment be to the three-man defensive line? You just run at them. And why did TCU line up with three men? One, they thought they could beat Michigan, but two, they were adjusting to the quarterback of Michigan, who's a great passer. And so by putting only three men on the line, they had everybody else was a linebacker or defensive back. And think about all the interceptions they got last night. The point that I'm making is life is full of curveballs. And the real question is, what do you do? Last Sunday, some of you were here. We had a curveball last Sunday. And what was that? The heat was out. But you know what? Just because the heat was out, I said to myself, I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to get angry. But we're just going to move forward. And in life, you have to make a decision like that, which says we either move forward or we stand still. And I tell you, if you stand still, you are going backwards. And so let me wrap this up for you. Life is full of curveballs. And when I think about Mary and Joseph getting a curveball, the curveball can go both ways. You know, often when we think about a curveball, like the heat being out last week, you know, that's something that can be problematic and devastating. But sometimes the curveball is a good thing. I bet you there's somebody here who's received a curveball at some point in your life, which was a job opportunity. But when you get a job opportunity, very often it's frightening. And it's frightening because you begin to ask yourself, what does this really mean? And, you know, somebody's offering me more money, but more responsibility, more obligation. And very often in life, the curveball is something good. George Cohen, think about when you were offered to be the principal at Castech. That was a curveball. I'm sure, and I don't know, I don't remember all the dynamics in that process. But you were offered an opportunity. And the question, some people don't want the opportunity. Some people don't want the raise because they don't want the responsibility. And so the curveball goes both ways, positively and negatively. But we have to ask ourselves, what do I do with that curveball? The last thing I want to say about Joseph and Mary is that Joseph and Mary felt responsible for the baby Jesus. Think about where I'm going with this. They are the parents of the Messiah. You know, God is the father of this immaculate conception, but on earth, Joseph and Mary are responsible for that little baby boy. And because they're responsible for that little baby boy, Joseph and Mary feel like they cannot let their guard down. They're just like you and me. They're just like all of us who felt responsible for children at some point in life. And if you've ever felt responsible for a child, you know that you may have to make a decision that the child cannot make for himself or herself. And Mary and Joseph are responsible for Jesus. And in a sense, you and I are responsible for Jesus, just like Mary and Joseph. And you may ask me, you say, but Reverend, how can I be responsible for Jesus when Jesus is the Savior of the world? And I tell you how you are responsible for Jesus. You are responsible for Jesus because the world is looking at you. And me. The world can't see Jesus, but they can see you and they can see me. And because the world can see you and the world can see me, then you and I have to be responsible for the Lord. We are the responsible witnesses for Jesus. And in the process of being the responsible witness for Jesus, we either bring people to the Lord or we chase people away from the Lord. And that is really what life as a Christian is all about. 37 years ago, when I became pastor of this church, I wanted to modernize the music. And I created a group, a singing group, called the Voices of Plymouth, led by a young man who had been in Sunday school with me, Chester Carter. And I said, Chester, can you put together a little vocal group? And it was just four people. Chester as a tenor. He had a bass and he had two sisters who were alto and a soprano. And they used to sing a song that went like this. Who will be a witness for my Lord? who will be a witness for my Lord? And then they would come back and sing, I will be a witness for my Lord. I will be a witness for my Lord. And I think about that song today, and I think about how important it is to be able to say, I will be a witness for the Lord. I don't know about you, but I am a witness for the Lord. Everywhere I go, every person I meet, everything I do, every word that I say, I am a witness for my Lord. And why am I a witness for my Lord? I am a witness for my Lord because the Lord has been mighty good to me. I'm a witness for the Lord because the Lord has saved me. I'm a witness for the Lord because the Lord died for me. I'm a witness for the Lord because I want to share the good news of what Jesus Christ is all about. And my friends, if God has done anything for you at all, if the Lord has saved your life, if the Lord has turned you around, if the Lord caught you when you were going in a bad direction and somehow put you on a right direction, you ought to be a witness for the Lord. And I tell you, I'm going to be a witness for the Lord until I die, because God has been so good to me. God has been better to me than I've been to myself. And all I can do is simply tell the world, Jesus has made a difference in my life. And so, my friends, if the Lord has made a difference in your life this day, I invite you to make a commitment to tell somebody, just like Mary and Joseph went out in front of Jesus, the little baby in Egypt, just as they looked out for Jesus in Egypt. I invite you to look out for Jesus right here where you are. God bless and God keep you. Amen.